One of the readings Krista did for us was Psalm 90. It's my favorite psalm. If I have to pick one out, I would say Psalm 90 is my favorite. It's one I've gone back to, returned to, and in fact, pretty recently within the life of our church, right after the new year, on New Year's, whatever that first Sunday was, I used Psalm 90 to talk about the idea of New Year's resolutions, about how it is that, you know, we kind of take stock and set out our plans and think, you know, this year, this is what we're going to do. And Psalm 90 is fitting towards that end. But, you know, a short while later, if you made any resolutions, I mean, they were a good chance they were disrupted, right? Because when we make New Year's resolutions, we're thinking that the upcoming year is going to be somewhat predictable, right? Enough so much so anyway that we can plan things. We think, you know, this year I'm going to do this. But not soon after that message was preached, there were already signs showing up that this year was quickly going to turn out to be something other than what was anticipated. But the psalm, applicable to the turn of the calendar, is still applicable, and frankly even more applicable than it was back in January. And that's because of the prayer, the petition, that comes about two-thirds of the way in this psalm, that comes out of the meditation upon the frailty, the fragility, the brevity of life. Well, in that regard, then, it's even more relevant. It says, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Now listen, I want to be sensitive here. I don't want to do all Corona all the time. You know, I mean, we've been meeting nightly for those who show up, you know, 6, 7, 8, sometimes a few more, Monday through Friday. And, you know, the focus has been the coronavirus. So we've been talking about anxiety and fear and the future and where hope, what rock upon we stand and so on. And here we are Sunday morning and I'm thinking, do we do more Corona? Well, yes, I think we ought to do more Corona. I think it's important. I think it's worthwhile to lean into this time. I mean, in the providence of God, a very significant event is taking place, and we'd be foolish to not want to understand its implications for our lives and for our faith. So, more coronavirus. You've heard the phrase carpe diem. You see, actually, is the name of the sermon for today. Carpe diem, it's translated or understood as the translation of a Latin. Latin is the carpe diem, as seize the day, seize the day. And this element, this idea has been expressed other ways. Famous poem, you know, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. And then there is YOLO, you only live once. All those are ways of expressing in some way, shape, or form this concept of carpe diem, seize the day. Now, this idea, particularly under the YOLO heading, you only live once, there can be a kind of a recklessness about it, seizing the day with like no thought to the future. And that leads to a kind of very individualistic expression or understanding of it, a very, frankly, selfish expression. You know, I've only lived once. I want to grab for all the gusto that I can. And it's not necessarily understanding that we are to pursue significance. It's really just hedonism. Maybe a lightweight way to express it is this idea of a bucket list, right? Before I die, I want to do this. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a desire for an experience that we anticipate will be extraordinary, something fulfilling. Well, this was also a kind of very famous phrase that came up in a movie called The Dead Poets Society. It starred Robin Williams. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but he's gathered there. He's at a private boys' school, supposedly up in Vermont, and a school which I believe he went to himself, and he's come back now as an English teacher. And he wants to teach poetry to these young men. And the scene is that he's in the hallway that maybe we might more relate, if you've ever been on high school or college campuses, that the hallway leading into the gymnasium, you know, because there's these trophy cases and pictures of the teams that won that trophy that year. And so he's there with all these young boys, and he asks them, does anybody know this phrase, carpe diem, or seize the day, gather your rosebuds while you may. And one young student says, carpe diem, seize the day. And he goes, that's right. And then he invites them all over closer to this case. And he begins to speak to him, and he says, you know, why is this phrase important? Why is carpe diem, seize the day, important? And he says this, because we are food for worms, lads. Believe it or not, everyone in this room is going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die. And then as they walk up to the case, he asks them to kind of lean in, and there's photos that are clearly from like the early 1900s. And they ask them to lean in and say, listen, can you hear anything? And then as they're all leaning in, focused on it, he speaks with a kind of like a voice coming from the grave. And he goes, seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary. There's a kind of nobility in that, but also a kind of tragedy. It suggests that there is great potential in each of them if they'd only take hold of the time given to them. Each of them can be extraordinary. But the tragedy is that in any real group of boys in a similar moment of challenge to make their lives extraordinary, almost all of them will live lives that are very, very ordinary. Almost all of them will live their lives unknown to all but a very few. Because the quest for an extraordinary life, which I would suggest is equivalent to seeking meaning, significance, making our lives count for something, it's going to be short-circuited. It's going to be short-circuited by disease, lack of opportunity. It could be short-circuited by lack of connections, by an injustice perpetrated against you. Frankly, it could be short-circuited by your own failures and ultimately, finally, death. That being said, I mean, there is something behind what he is encouraging them that has a kind of an important presupposition. And it's behind all of the phrases, gather your rosebuds while you may, the YOLO, you only live once, or seize the day. There is something that's very important. What is behind that is the idea of the brevity or the once and for all nature of life that it reflects. See, why seize the day? Because it is the only time that you'll live that day. And that day is the only one of so many days that we have on the earth. And in this regard, that's a Christian understanding of time. That's a biblical understanding of time. That time is linear. We only go through this life once. You only live once. And the days that we have in this space, the days given to us from conception in the womb to death, are relatively few. As Moses puts it in Psalm 90, the years of our life are 70, or if by reason of strength, 80. And though that was written thousands of years ago, it's still pretty much true. And that's what we expect, that we've got 70, 80 years. Because aren't you shocked? Aren't you shocked when you learn that someone who was 35, 40, 45, 50, 65, the year they died, they go, oh, they were robbed of their life. Because we expect that we'll have at least 70, 80, and if by reason of strength these days, even more. Well, the fact is we only have so many days, and we don't know how many days we have, and we need to, therefore, seize the day. But to what purpose? To what end? Is there anything outside of us to give meaning to our days? That is, when these young men are challenged to make their lives extraordinary, it suggests that there's some standard, some model, some goal that exists by which they can say at the end of the day, my life was extraordinary. And what is the standard? Well, it might be something within us. It might be something where a kind of an internal bucket list that is more than the experiences that we might normally think of, a personal goal that you want to achieve even if no one else knows it. I suspect, though, that that is pretty rare. Usually, the standard is set by others. It's the pressure to measure up to what our society equates with success or significance, money, material goods, mostly notoriety. And too often, not because we have achieved something in our field, but just because people know who we are. We're noticed. We're a celebrity. I mean, we have people that are famous just for being famous. But even if our standard is weightier, even if our standard is weightier than what Kim Kardashian is wearing these days, a look at history can uncover that standards, what brings meaning, can change. Now, if I understand the notion of modernity rightly, beginning with the Enlightenment, humanity shrugged off its limitations and began to think that anything was possible. Through improvement, progress was inevitable. And all that threatened our progress, even the length of our days, was something that could be conquered if we just put our minds and energies to it. And a lot of developments and improvements were accomplished. I mean, the quality of life increased exponentially, at least for those who live in places that had access to the kind of fruit of this enterprise. But that optimism was shattered after two world wars, multiple genocides, death camps, and the threat of atomic annihilation. Suddenly, the future didn't seem so secure. The standard by which we were going to measure progress was suddenly undermined by the very progress that we made, the developments, the scientific advancements, actually produced something that would completely and utterly destroy us. And what has not been conquered, no matter how much anybody has tried, even with the extraordinary advances in medicine, is the 70 to 80 years that Moses speaks of. That constraint on our existence remains. And for those willing to face the question of their mortality, well, we're still left with the question of how we should live our lives. What will give our lives meaning? How might we seize the day? How might we make our lives extraordinary? Let's look at Psalm 90 for a little bit. Now, it begins with a healthy embrace of our mortality and the reason for our mortality. The first thing it sets out is what we might say is the eternality of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place. That is, we have lived within him, as it were. In you, we live and move and have our being, Paul says. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. A clear picture of a God who stands apart from creation. He's not part of creation. He's not a product of creation in any way, shape, or form. He stands self-existent, and then he speaks creation into being. And it's in that reality that he brings into being that we have our own existence. You have been our dwelling place in all generations. So there is the eternality of God now compared with our own, let's call it temporality, that we live within time. Now, one of the things that God does when he creates is that he creates time. Time is something that we live in. Time is something that is inescapable for us. And it's something that he enters into through the incarnation or through his dealings with human beings, through his revelation in his word. He enters into our time, but God's not limited by it, yet we are. And that's what the next several verses point out. Listen to verse 3. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man. Let's pause there for a minute. Now, if you recall the story, the biblical narrative of how it was when God made human beings, what does he do? He takes Adam, and we're told that he takes him, forms him from the dust of the ground. It's like he's created this sculpture, this statue, and he breathes life into it and became a living being. After what we call the fall in Christianity, that is after the human beings rebelled against the God's provision for them and his commandment for them, after they rebelled, he tells Adam that he is going to return back to dust. From dust you came, and to dust you shall return. That is the reality of who we are, as verse 3 says. You return man to dust, and you say, O children of man, in fact, that word man is the Hebrew word which you could make Adam. that Adam is synonymous, the term is synonymous with man. Sometimes it's used in its universal way, sometimes it refers to the people, to the person, excuse me. But he says, return, O children of man, return, O children of Adam, he who is told that he's going to return back to dust. And then it goes on to talk about, for the next several verses, the real frailty then of our existence, the insubstantial nature of it, the fragility of it. He goes on and says this, for 1,000 years in your sight are as but yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. It's brief, right? God's not constrained by time as we are. He doesn't think about time that way as we do. 1,000 years for God, it's like a day. But he goes on, you sweep them away, that is these days, you sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning it flourishes and renewed, and in the evening it fades and withers. That's how our everyday life is compared to the eternality of God. They're like a breath. He says this now in verse 7, for we are brought to an end by your anger. That is, our insubstantiality, our fragility, our frailty is due to the fact of God's anger. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you and our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all of our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. Now, that's not a comforting thought for many people, that every day we live underneath the wrath of God. But that's the reality of it. And what's interesting to think about, now, the author of this psalm is Moses. And if you know anything about Moses, you know that he was chosen by God to go down into Egypt, where the people of God had been held captive and been turned, they entered there not as captives, but they became slaves. And Moses is sent because God hears the cries of his people looking for deliverance. And so Moses is chosen, he is sent to go down and deliver them. And so he takes them out, and they are supposed to go into the promised land. They rebel, they don't go. So now they're wandering around the desert for some 40 years. The reason why they're wandering for 40 years is because God said that they should go into the promised land, that he would go ahead of them and clear out all the enemies that would plague them, but they refused to go in. And so for the 40 years that Moses is leading them in the wilderness, they are living under the wrath of God. All of our days pass under your wrath. There's another connection that's made to James Boyce, who's a theologian, pastor, a teacher that was formerly in Philadelphia. The late James Boyce passed away a number of years ago. He thinks the background for this psalm could very well be the events recorded in Numbers chapter 20, when we read of the death of Miriam, we read of the death of Aaron, we read of Moses striking the rock rather than speaking to the rock. I won't explain all those stories if you don't know them. But what that ended up doing, because he didn't speak to the rock but struck the rock, Moses is prohibited from going into the promised land. So he knows that the rest of the time that he's going to be leading these people, and it's a substantial amount of time, he is not going to get the reward of going into the promised land. So we can have a keen sense that Moses knows well what he is talking about. All our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. And then he says, the years of our life are 70, if by reason of strength 80, yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. A poetic imagery, poetic analogy, metaphor for the nature of our life and how insubstantial it is, how dependent it is. And all of that modernity's hubris, you know, just it's exposed by the fact that indeed, you know, our life is given to us by God. Our life is given given so that life is breathed into us. We're from dust, and to dust we're going to return. And so when Moses contemplates the nature of his existence, he looks at that in relationship to the secure, solid eternality of God and what might have been in God's and human beings' relationship with God, looks at that and recognizes just what a loss. What what a loss, what life might have been like. And that, there's this one really interesting verse right here in verse 11. And it's variously translated because it's a difficult verse in the original. But listen to what it says. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? What does he mean? I think what he means is this. You know, when we go out, for instance, out into the out into a place where we can look up and see the expanse of heaven, right? Or we, you know, we see the cloud of the Milky Way, or we people talk about light years that are, you know, 150,000 light years away, and you try to do the math on that. Or even just looking at something small and glorious and beautiful, like a flower, and you think, you know, God created all of this. And when we contemplate that reality of God, that majesty of God, we are humbled, we step back. Now, what if we understand that that same God who creates heaven and earth, who sustains everything, who has that creative power to create the expanse of the universe and that glorious flower in your hand, is angry? What kind of anger would such a God possess? How wrathful would he be when his creature turns his back on him? When he says, I don't need to listen to you. I can be like you. That's what he says. That's what Adam believes. That's what he embraces when the serpent says, you can be like God. And so I think Moses is asking, who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear that is due you, the fear of you? So when we think about the holiness of God and how much we ought to reverence him, and then we have to match that majesty, that incomprehensibility with his wrath. And he asks, who considers it? And the implied answer is, no one. We don't really think that God has every right to possess majestic wrath, awe-inspiring wrath. But were we to do so, were we to take that to heart, it leads to the petition that we spoke of earlier in this. So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. See, if we sit and contemplate the frailty of our lives, if we realize that their frailty is due to the wrath of God, then the petition is that we would be awakened to the implications of that reality. And while I've said already that Moses, you know, looks upon his experience and can say from personal experience that we live every day under our wrath, Moses here is speaking as a representative of all human beings. He speaks from his experience, but he speaks for all of us. And the constraints of having only so many years, of which it speaks, it's true for all of us, right? And for the same reasons. We have only so many years for the same reasons that Moses articulates. It's because of that, then there's a prayer that rises up within Moses that's kind of an equivalent to this seize the day. Teach us to number our days. Why? So that we might gain a heart of wisdom, that we might get a heart of wisdom. How will we live out our days? I mean, we know we will have days. By God's grace, we'll have days. If by reason of strength, 70 or 80. We will have days, but how do we live them? Again, I've said this often, I'll say it again. My favorite definition of wisdom is knowledge rightly applied. Knowledge rightly applied. The knowledge that we have, that we live out our days, we live under the wrath of God, we live only because he sustains us. How does that knowledge turn into wisdom? How can we have a mature, seasoned understanding of ourselves and the nature of our existence, which teaches us how we ought to live? Well, I think the rest of this psalm is an acknowledgement of the lack of capacity that we have to live as we are supposed to live. And so there's several petitions, several pleas that are made. The first is that God would have pity on us. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Have pity on us. You know, God looks upon us and he knows our frailty. Jesus has experienced it, right? He understands what it's like to live in a broken, fallen world. He experienced all of it. And the reality is that he experienced that entire human life, and yet did so without sin, which is why he could be that perfect sin bearer for us. But he knows, he understands. And so he can have pity. Jesus does have pity on us. So we first ask that God have pity on us, to remember our frames, that we are indeed from dust. And that this coming to an understanding, this coming to a realization of how we might live wisely would come to us sooner rather than later. Listen what he says. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, your covenant-keeping love. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all of our days. The sooner, the better, God, teach us this. And that going forward, despite our frailty, we would experience God's pleasure. He says in verse 15, make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen evil. Can we balance this out? Can we balance this out? I mean, think of Moses, that he lived all those days knowing that he wasn't going into the promised land. And yet he asked God, please balance this out. Make me glad for as many days as you have afflicted me, for as many years as I have seen evil. And again, he speaks for all of us. Yeah. That going forward, despite our frailty, we would experience God's pleasure, and that we would have eyes to see and an ability to contemplate the majesty of God displayed in his works. Listen to what he says. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Again, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. What is it that we follow up that petition with? That God would be, that he would pity us. That he would come and establish this in us sooner rather than later. That going forward, despite our frailty, we would experience God's pleasure. And that we would have the ability to the eyes to see, the ability to contemplate the majesty of God displayed in his works. And that knowing that, experiencing that, it would establish the work of our hands. Listen to what it says in verse 17. Now, here in the ESV, it says, let the favor of the Lord be upon us. And we need the favor of the Lord. And certainly that is part of the desire that we have if we're going to live our days out wisely, that God's favor, his grace, his mercy would be upon us. But in the King James, the New King James, there's another translation, even in the footnote here in the ESV, will be there. It says, let the beauty of the Lord, let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. I think that's a better translation, frankly. And why is because previous to thee, we're asking that God would understand his works, that we might see, that they might be shown to us, his glorious power. And God's beauty is on display. His majesty, the completeness of his attributes, the glory of his being. And we see that in the works that he has done. And we're asking then that that beauty of God, that incomprehensible beauty, that unmatchable beauty of God, would, knowing that, contemplating it, seeing it, it would establish the work of our hands. That's what we want, right? When we talk about seize the day, make your life significant, live an extraordinary life, we want our works to be established. We want something, our lives to have some meaning to them. That all that we're doing on a daily basis amounts to something. It isn't just, well, even though our life is insubstantial, but what it is that we are doing has meaning. So our significance then, how will we have the significance? It's going to be by God establishing the work of our hands. That is, from our being brought into God's great purpose, right? He's the beginning. He's the end of all things. God is moving history forward. It's linear. He's moving to the new heavens and the new earth. And each one of us is brought into the earth and has the opportunity to participate in what God is doing. That's where the significance of each of our days will come from. Each day we live with the constraints of our lives and the constraints of God's plan. And the significance of our lives comes from the fulfilling of our calling as God has set it out. Right? We have only 70, 80 years, but we're also constrained by God, the controller of history. Our lives are controlled by our own frailty, but also by God's plan. And our significance will come when we enter in God's plan. You know, this constraint of our mortality, reminded these days with the coronavirus, this is actually a good thing. Oz Guinness says this, if you know who he is, theologian, intellectual. He says this: brevity of life is like the frame of a picture, or a sports field for a game, or a term for a student. It gives the framework and focus that gives you the intensity and the motivation. Right? You know you've got exams coming up at the end of the semester, and you buckle down. When you're out there for the hour on the field, then you're focused. You're focused on getting to at the end of that game, that you've won the game, that you've played your hardest. And that's what he says, this constraint, this brevity of our life actually affords us. It can get us focused and can get us motivated. And we can view this pandemic as something which reminds us of the brevity of our lives and can give us focus, intensity, motivation. We can purpose to use this to reevaluate, what are we setting as a standard for having lived our lives with meaning? What is that standard? Is it going to be something set by outside of us, by the world, by some sort of sense of our own selves and our ego? Or will it be established by God himself? That's where our meaning will come from. We can decide that what God wants to establish as the work of our hands will be sufficient for us for meaning. And that's a hard one. You know, we look upon entering into God's plan and saying, you know, God, you shape my life. You direct my life. And we think of all the things that we lose if we do that. That's how we view it. We view it as a loss. But in reality, coming into it, coming into God's plan, coming underneath his calling, is where we find our meaning, our significance. Because, believe it or not, that's how we've been created. To find our meaning, our significance as image bearers of God who have been set in this earth to reflect his being and to serve him. Listen to what John says, what Jesus says in John 15, which we looked at on Easter. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. Joy comes from a sense of satisfaction. Joy comes from a sense of meaning, of purpose. And that's going to come to us, Jesus says, if we know his commandments. That is, we get with God's plan for our lives. That's why we pray, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That we are praying that God would take charge of our lives, establish the work of our hands, so that every day that we have, we are living wisely. Now, I want to say just two more things and I'll be done. I know I've been talking for a while. I want to go back to that language of satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we might rejoice all of our days. Now, each one of us can pray this every day when we rise. Yeah? Satisfy us in the morning. Each day we ask God to establish the work of our hands. But listen, I want to speak to those of you who have more years ahead of me, more years ahead of you than I do. I'm 67 years old, and there's some of you that are 27 years old. That's a 40-year difference. And if we have, by reason of strength, 80 years, that's half of your life. 40 years from now, unless I've been eating a lot of yogurt and living right late, and maybe drinking, I don't know, not as much as I do right now, I might live to be 107, but I doubt it. More than likely 40 years from now, I won't be here anymore, but you will be. If by reason of strength, at that point, when you're 27, you would then be 67, you'd be right where I am right now. And I want you to take seriously what Moses is praying for, that you would establish us early, that we might, as he says, rejoice and be glad all of our days. Because that 40-year difference, that's a 40-year difference from now. And as I said, that could be half of your allotted days. I want to encourage you to use this time of pandemic as a time to pray with Moses to have the work of your hands established. There's, you know, when you're younger, there is such an energy about the future, such a hope that's placed upon it. And, you know, you think of the high school students graduating, the college students graduating, people completing their programs, and all of that has been undermined. You know, the promise that all that holds, the expectation that, yeah, well, I'm not going to end up like you ended up. I'm going to conquer the world. And that kind of hubris, that comes with being who we are as children of Adam. But there is something right about that, that our life does want to have significance. It does want to have meaning. And I want to encourage you, as a 67-year-old to someone who's 27 or 37, I want to encourage you that now, in this time, to evaluate these things and ask God to establish the work of your hands. Because 40 years from now, you'll be able to look back and said God was faithful to answer that prayer. And the last thing I want to say is I want to just briefly touch on that passage from Ephesians chapter 5 that was read for us. And just to highlight one particular verse. He says, "Look carefully then how you walk, not as wise but unwise, making the best use of the time because the days are evil." You know, that making the best use of the time is actually the Greek word that gets translated elsewhere as redeem. The word that used that Jesus worked to redeem us. And to redeem something is to ransom it, to set it free. And so what Paul is saying is make the best use, redeem the time because the days are evil. You know, how do we redeem? We can with the help of God, as we purpose to find our meaning of our existence in Him and His purposes for us. We set our time free from vanity, from false standards, framed only by death and not by life. Redeem the time because the days are evil. That isn't just His days. All days are that way. Until that the heavens and earth pass away and the new heavens and earth come, we live in the midst of evil days. And it's a call to release, to ransom, to set free the days that we do have from all these other things that might cause us to lose the opportunity granted to us. Well, I've been talking for a very long time. And again, it is almost Corona all the time. And I'm sorry about that. But I do pray that God will help us to number our days, that we might gain wisdom as to how we are to live. And I'm saying that the only way that's really going to happen is if we bring ourselves with Moses' prayer to ask God to establish the work of our hands. That we come into His plan, His purpose, His constraints upon our life, and we find our joy in them. Let's pray.